And a good morning. I'm Alan Kaith in for Ed. Ed is taking some time off, and so we agreed to help him and do a couple of shows for Mr. Ackerley, who basically is here in this chair on Mondays and Fridays. My special guests today include a good friend of mine from how many years?
Let's see.
It's been a while.
Over a decade. How's that?
When you were much younger. I mean, yes. You were just a little pup.
Just a little kid.
Barely
back in
able
the day.
To drive that Scion that you drive now.
I barely got my driver's license when you knew me.
David Layton from the Arizona Daily Star Street Smarts column and author of the story of Hughes, basically, in Tucson. Tell me the title of that, your Hughes contribution. I want to get it all out there before we get into what we're doing now.
Yeah, the history of the... It's been so many years. The history of the Hughes Missile Plant in Tucson, 1947 to 1960. It's just in libraries. There's only a few copies of that, so...
But it's quite engaging to see that, because I've seen, you know, some of what you wrote, and it's...
Yeah.
I don't know how you research that stuff, because a lot of these people are not around, you know, either in Tucson or just living.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's going through old archives, the newspapers. Sometimes it's interviewing people that are still alive. Sometimes it's books people have written. Sometimes, you know, following the family members, sometimes they'll have little write-ups that they, you know, they did for their grandkids or something like that. So a lot of research, a lot of time.
You spent a lot of time researching. It was probably, what, 95.5, would you say? 5% writing, 95% research?
I would say it's probably closer to 85% time is spent on research, about 15% writing. So,
and then your latest incarnation in this book, have you done anything other than the Hughes Street Smarts and this that I don't know about recently?
I mean, back in 2019, I did a story on photographer Ray Manley.
Oh, yeah.
That came out in the Arizona Highways magazine. That was September 2019. It's got a beautiful cover of a Navajo woman on a horse. Hugely popular, probably a collector's edition. I did the part on Ray Manley. It's like the best photographers of Arizona, and I did the Ray Manley story on that one in September 2019.
So. You got to talk to his son, right?
Son and daughter. I spoke to both of them. Got to see some of the archives and stuff like that. So, but he had a really interesting story as well.
Now, under your current project, which is the quarterly of the Arizona Historical Society, and that's my next guest who's here with David C. Turpey. Basically the editor of this publication, the Journal of Arizona History.
That's correct, yes.
It's a quarterly softback publication, volume 65, summer of 2024, talking about Arizona's zoos. And quite an interesting read. I read most of it. Didn't read a lot about the Phoenix Zoo history, David, because I lived there and I left there. But there's quite a bit there, and it's an impressive story about the Phoenix Zoo because they got a 50-year head start on us, basically, David. They started in the teens, and we started in the 60s, pretty much. Is that not correct?
No, the Phoenix Zoo was founded in the early 60s as well, so...
Why do I remember something about the 1915s about the Phoenix Zoo?
Well, so there were we have two articles in this special issue of the Journal of Arizona History. What, as you said, one on the Phoenix Zoo, and then David's excellent article on the Reed Park Zoo. And so I decided to do a little bit of research of my own and write the introduction to this issue. I thought it would be good for our readers to kind of understand what came before the two major zoos were founded. So I did some digging, and especially in newspapers, and found that there were a number of zoos that sort of came and went, starting in the 19-teens. The first zoo that I could find in Arizona was in Prescott, actually, the Murphy Park Zoo. But then I think the zoo you're referring to was in Riverside Park in Phoenix. And that lasted, as far as I could tell, that lasted for maybe 2 or 3 years. And then basically the newspaper accounts are kind of sketchy on what exactly happened, but it sounded like basically the zoo was just sort of abandoned by whoever was running it, and the animals were just sort of left to die. And so a local Humane Society officer eventually was alerted to the fact that these animals are dying there, and he went and rescued as many as he could, and that was in 1915. So you see that pattern throughout the early years.
Kind of just a holding place for animals that we don't know what to do with.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, the newspapers did not talk about who owned or operated Riverside Park Zoo. I could not find that. Most of the other examples, like the one in Prescott, it's basically sort of a rich guy who, this is his hobby, is collecting animals, usually kind of exotic animals. And so the problem is it's expensive to keep exotic animals. And so they often, these guys would sort of say, I don't want to spend this money anymore. So they'd try to hand over their zoos to the city, mm-hmm. Or the county. And they were pretty much always turned down. So these early zoos in Arizona usually only lasted 2, 3, maybe 5 years before they were shut down.
With me, a surprise guest, my offspring, my number 4 child, age 16, and in the veterinary sciences program at JTED, Nicole Kaith. Hello, Nicole.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nicole read your book, and she is very interested in animals, especially birds. She volunteers at the Paradise Parrot Rescue, the Humane Society. She's got a job locally, a paying job in a pet store. But you and I were talking about that gentleman in Prescott today, and you had a question about, you know, why would he just let these animals go, right, even though he was rich?
Right. So I was wondering about that, just because it seems like it would have been such a difficult task acquiring all those animals in the first place. So for him to just kind of be trying so hard to find someone to take them, I was wondering if you guys knew maybe why that would be.
I don't know that I have a great answer. I think, you know, he tried over a number of years to mm-hmm. to sort of offload them, first with the city of Prescott. And from what I could tell from newspaper reports, city leaders were interested, but the budget just couldn't withstand.
Couldn't afford it.
And so eventually he worked out a deal with the city of Los Angeles. They were creating a new zoo in Griffith Park, mm-hmm. Which is where the zoo still is there, to take over his animals. So I don't really necessarily have the full story about Frank Murphy.
Right.
I want to say that I think he was sort of nearing retirement age, and maybe he was just sort of, I think he moved out of state after he retired, and so maybe that was just sort of part of his retirement plan would be my guess.
We'll take the break and be right back. You're listening to Jump In Too Soon. And Wood, great Rex Harrison and Dr. Doolittle, our Jump In Too Soon return theme. I'm Alan Kaith for Ed Ackerley on Monday morning. We, and the push me, pull you, we didn't see any of those up in Prescott, did we? The llama with the two heads on each side from Dr. Doolittle. I don't think there is such a thing. It's fun to think of that, though. But with me, the Davids, David Layton and David Turpey. David, the writer for the segment of the Reed Park Zoo in the Journal of Arizona History, the summer edition. And Mr. Turpey is the editor of said publication. So, Nicole, my daughter, has another quick question about the Riverside Zoo. And then we're going to get to Mr. Layton's Reed Park and Randolph. Randolph first, then Reed Park, same zoo.
Correct.
So you had mentioned earlier that it had kind of closed down.
The Riverside Zoo.
The Riverside Zoo after a big storm, right? So I was kind of wondering, were there any attempts to reopen the zoo?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, city leaders in Phoenix and especially the newspaper in Phoenix, they were very interested in having a Phoenix mm-hmm. zoo. A lot of city leaders, not just in Phoenix, but around the country, see a zoo as a sort of a symbol for a city that sort of made it. And so, you know, leaders in Phoenix, often in the early 1900s, mid-1900s, had a vision for Phoenix as one of those sort of big-time cities. And having a zoo, I think, was a part of that vision. So you constantly sort of see that, especially in the newspaper, the Arizona Republic, used to be the Republican. You see that constantly, this refrain of, we need a zoo, we need a zoo, we need a zoo, throughout the 19-teens up through the 1950s. And then, of course, finally in the 60s, it works out.
We got a zoo in the 60s here. We got a zoo in Phoenix in the 60s. Apparently, it was like, we got to both have, the big cities both have to have it. And so there's like a little bit of peer pressure maybe between the cities.
Yeah, I mean, leading Tucsonans wanted a zoo, starting in the 19-teens at least as well. Arizona, Phoenix and Tucson both getting a zoo finally in the 60s. That's almost a century behind the first zoos in the United States. The first zoo in the U.S. was in Philadelphia sometime in the early 1870s, I think. So Arizona's almost a century behind. So you see that a lot, too, looking through old newspapers. People in Tucson, Phoenix sort of saying, why can't we have a zoo? Everyone else seems to have one.
Because we're the 49th state.
Right.
And we were, in a state in 1912 as opposed to back in the 17s and 1800s is the answer for that, I think.
Yeah.
48th state.
Oh, sorry. You're right. 48th, Alaska and Hawaii.
Yeah, 49th.
For some reason, I keep forgetting Hawaii. I don't know why. Back to you now. We're going to start with your contribution to this quarterly publication, and you started with the history of the Randolph Zoo. That's what it was called initially, and then it was changed by somebody that I think was a great man here, Gene C. Reed. So tell me how it started, David.
So back in 1965, you had Gene Reed and who was head of Tucson Parks and Rec, and his number two guy, Emerson Hall. They took a trip out to Texas. They did some training in Texas, and I can only guess at this point that they stopped by the Lubbock Parks and Rec Prairie Dog Town. That's just a guess. I know they went out there and trained. Mm-hmm. But either way, they conceived the idea, either Emerson Hall or Gene C. Reed conceived the idea of a prairie dog town in Tucson. And
we had no prairie dogs. They're not native to the area, right?
I think there's
actually... We have ground squirrels, but I think they're the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were some prairie dogs in Cochise County, actually, that existed prior to this. That may have just crossed over from Texas. I'm not sure. I did read an article back in the 30s that said there was some there. That's the only thing I ever found on that. But they conceived the idea, either one or two or both conceived the idea of a prairie dog town. And they, Emerson Hall had his friend Stump Hamilton, who ran the Lubbock, Tucson Parks and Rec, Lubbock Parks and Recreation in Texas, ship out some prairie dogs.
Some dogs.
Yeah, some dogs out to Tucson. Emerson Hall oversaw the construction of the prairie dog town, which was like an octagon-shaped enclosure with lots of dirt, a few trees, and stuff like that.
Soft dirt, not caliche.
Yeah, soft dirt.
You got to be able to dig with those little
right.
feet.
Those cute little feet. And so that's how the whole thing started, was a prairie dog town.
And then what happened after that, after the dogs came? Something else happened.
So after that, there was a lady who had some pheasants, we'll call them. And they were causing a lot of problems. They were very noisy and squeaky and stuff like that. And it was driving the neighbors crazy. So she contacted Gene C. Reed and said, hey, can I donate these to you? And he said, okay. And then so they created a cage next to the prairie dog town, and that was the next animal in line.
When did the monkey come?
The monkey came, I think, within a few months of the prairie dog opening. Prairie dog town opened in April, late April 1965. It was within a few months the monkey came. Somebody had offered Gene C. Reed a monkey. And a monkey, of course, is a wild animal. It's not a domestic animal. And Reed was basically just trying to create like a petting zoo. It was sort of like the Randolph Park petting zoo. And so he contacted, because it was a wild animal, he contacted the city manager, Markeen. He said, hey, what do we do with this thing, you know, this monkey? And Markeen's reaction was, well, I guess we're going to have to start a zoo.
Good. I'm glad he came to that conclusion.
Right. And after that, people just started donating more and more animals. And sometimes they were, you know, dropping off rabbits and other, you know, domestic animals and stuff like that. So the first year, it was just basically a petting zoo. It happened to have a monkey in it.
Who donated the elephant?
So the elephant, Sabu, we had Alma Jet brought her traveling zoo to Tucson. They were posted at the Elcon Mall at the time, and Sabu was just getting too big for the traveling vehicles they had. So she wanted to donate Sabu to a zoo or give it away. And so she decided to sell the elephant for $2,000 to the zoo. Now, Gene C. Reed thought this would be great to have an elephant. Kids would love it.
He's right.
Yeah, and that's what really kind of blew up the zoo. But so she actually donated, Alma Jet actually donated $1,000 herself because she wanted to make sure this happened. And then they got the money, the extra $1,000, and Sabu became part of the Randolph Park Children's Zoo.
Now, David, it ballooned from there in the 60s and 70s, right? We can go through all the, if you want to give me stories, quick stories of how the different animals came. I want to get to the 70s kind of quick because inflation and problems with funding zoos came into play.
Yeah, I mean, after Sabu came in, people just started donating stuff, and they started buying animals. Reed started buying animals. And there's too many animals to describe how they came in. I know there were some kangaroos that came in from Australia that Reed had negotiated for. There was polar bears brought in from Russia, which created a whole controversy. And
why?
Because people in Tucson didn't think that a polar bear
in the desert
was a good idea. You know, it's a cold weather animal, and Tucson is not a cold weather temperature place.
Yeah.
So that started controversy and, you know, led to other controversies and stuff like that. But a lot of them were donations. Some Reed bought, some Reed traded animals for other animals. I mean, just, there was so many different types of animals.
He really had a vision to build something great there, didn't he?
Yeah, I think Reed's goal ultimately was to create a zoo for the children of Tucson. He wanted it centrally located, which Reed Park, of course, was.
Still is.
Yeah, it still is, of course. And he wanted to keep it free, which it no longer is now, but that's just because of the expenses. But his goal was to create a centrally located zoo that was free to the children of Tucson was his goal.
And the park, once he retired, got named after him.
Right. So it was really originally Randolph Park, and then once he retired in 1978, they changed it to Reed Park, and then the zoo changed its name to the Reed Park Zoo.
Reed Park Zoo.
Yeah.
And it's still growing today. I just don't think that there's a lot of donated animals anymore, right? Like none.
I don't know. I would think not. I think they're a lot more selective, but that I don't know for sure.
I know we have a new elephant exhibit, relatively new. So that first elephant was kind of a neat incarnation of what is now a pretty impressive elephant display over there at the Reed Park Museum. It's huge.
Yeah, I was just there yesterday or the day before, filming with Channel 9, and it's a massive place. And those elephants are amazing.
Back with the Davids, David Turpie and David Layton, and a little bit more discussion on the Journal of Arizona History's quarterly edition featuring Arizona zoos. Specifically, we're talking about the Reed Park Zoo. I'm Alan Kaith for Ed Ackerley on Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after the break. That is absolutely wrong. They're very smart. They know a lot. So, but the song is a great song for
right,
Simon and Garfunkel.
Exactly.
David Layton and David Turpie are here. David is the editor of the Arizona Historical Society's Journal of Arizona History, which is right off the U of A main campus. David Layton writes for The Star, the Street Smarts column, and also does some great freelance, highly researched stories about Hughes, Ray Manley, and others probably in the works. Tell me about your recent award that I got invited to help you eat lunch with.
Yeah, so the Tucson the Tucson Pima County Historic Commission awarded me a preservation award for the 12 years of writing the Street Smarts column, which is quite prestigious, considering the fact that nobody in the media has won one for years, at least 5 years, if not more. Most of the awards went to like architects and people that rebuild.
Builders,
like,
right.
Yeah, builders, architects that save like churches and adobe houses and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I was the only one in the media to win that type of preservation award.
It was an impressive day. I remember that over at the little church at Fort Lowell.
Yeah, that was little chapel.
Neat. And
yeah.
The food was pretty good too.
The food was excellent. You know me, I love to eat.
Well, so. Me too. You've got a tapeworm, but I'm right behind you. My daughter Nicole Kaith is here, who loves animals and who's in the veterinary science program at JTED and also goes to high school here. Nicole, what's your question about, you heard something that kind of keyed you on the polar bear protests.
So, I know after the polar bears arrived from Moscow, there was kind of a whole thing where people were upset maybe that they weren't be taken care of correctly, and it kind of snowballed into the people having issues with all sorts of other animals and their care as well. Would you like to expand a little bit on that?
Sure. So the controversy related to the polar bears actually started right before they actually arrived. When they first announced that polar bears were being brought in from Russia, people, animal activists, started protesting at city council meetings that they didn't think this was the right place, that Tucson was not the right place to have these majestic animals, which are cold weather animals. Got worse after they actually showed up, because it came out that they were only going to get a 10 by 12 concrete slab enclosure. Which is just in a tiny pool for them to swim in.
And there was no cooling for the pool or the enclosure, correct?
Correct. That is correct, yeah. So people just thought it was kind of cruel that you would bring an animal like that into Tucson with the weather the way it is. So there was a lot of protests over that. People didn't really like it. That actually kind of started the change of the zoo from more of a concrete and, you know, chain link fence bar type of zoo into what is more today, which is more natural enclosures and things that are like, you know, just it's more natural environment. If you go to the zoo today, you'll see a hugely different zoo than was back in the 1960s and 1970s. But that actually started the controversy and started in a good way, started changing things to a more humane zoo and a better environment for the animals.
In the 70s, I remember lines for gas. You were probably about two or maybe three.
I was born in 1979, so
you missed all the gas war stuff, and yeah. So did you. I remember that.
I didn't really miss it.
Oh, you didn't miss it?
No,
meaning you didn't like it.
No, I didn't miss it. Like I didn't want to be a part of that, so I'm not gonna miss it.
Good.
Hopefully that won't happen again.
You were on foot then. Because I remember my dad sitting in those lines. And so to move toward other things other than high gas, the price of food for zoo animals was also very high. Mm-hmm. Everything was like it is kind of now with
right.
food and
everything's
fuel
insanely
and everything
expensive
else.
Today.
And so how did the zoos in Phoenix and in Tucson handle that?
So I know I can speak to the Tucson Zoo. So they started kind of an adopt an animal program at the Randolph Park Zoo, which is now the Reed Park Zoo, where individuals would adopt an animal, and then their money would be put towards feeding the animals and getting them care. So that's how they kind of dealt with it in the 70s, is they had an adopt an animal program, and that's how they kind of paid for the food and the increase and stuff like that.
Do we know how much it costs to feed an elephant? I know you had some prices in there, but I can't imagine what it costs today. But back in the 70s, it was into the few thousands of dollars, wasn't it?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I don't know the exact number, but yeah, it was already expensive in the 70s. I'm sure it's insane now.
Oh, it's got to be outrageous. It probably would surprise all of us, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe it wouldn't surprise us because these animals are just so big, you know? Yeah. So, and I don't know, David, do you know about the Phoenix Zoo, how they dealt with that?
Similar?
I don't. I would assume there were similar things. Like, you talk about the Reed Park Zoo. There was a sort of a Friends of Reed Park Zoo group that was created, if I remember correctly, and...
Yeah, so the friends of the Randolph, what's it called? It's actually Friends of the Randolph
Park Zoo.
No, it was Friends of the Randolph Zoo Society. The name park is incorrectly used in the newspapers very commonly because people just say, "Oh, Friends of the Randolph Park Zoo," but it was actually Friends of the Randolph Zoo Society. The name park never existed in there. If you look at the official documents which I obtained, that didn't exist.
Okay.
But that was more originally, that was more for funding like new enclosures and stuff like that. It wasn't for like daily maintenance. That society didn't exist for that reason. I'm not sure. It's called something else now. I don't know if that role has changed. Back in the 1975, 1976 when it was first created, it had specific roles that it did and what it didn't do.
So they did capital expenditures for building new enclosures,
right,
but not necessarily feeding us.
Not the daily stuff of taking care of the animals. I don't, to the best of my recollection, they didn't do that stuff. It was for specific things.
What's the most surprising thing you, by doing this, learned about either the Phoenix, Prescott, Riverside, or Tucson Zoo, David?
I think the thing I was most surprised by and the little bit of research, I did not do as much research as...
Oh, he's the king of research.
He's the king of research.
Oh, yeah.
But the little bit of research I did to write the introduction for this issue, I was surprised by how the early zoos in Arizona from the 19-teens up through the 50s mostly had animals that were native to the region, which is very different than zoos, right? When you think of zoos, you think of elephants and giraffes and...
boa constrictors.
Yeah, animals that are from Africa or Asia, right? And so it was I never quite got a sense as to why these earlier. It was probably just easier to collect those animals, but that was the thing that surprised me the most.
Were there more limitations on what you could bring into the U.S. at that time?
There were limitations put in place at some point. Mm-hmm. I want to say that it came a little bit later, like the 30s. So some of those zoos in the teens and 20s would not have, you know. But before those limitations were put into place, it was the Wild West everywhere. You know, you could just sort of collect whatever you wanted, and no one cared.
No one said anything
about
it.
Yeah,
just go. Let's go see the petting zoo. See who's in there today. What's your most astute, surprising observation from your research on this?
I think the most surprising thing was that Gene C. Reed had a co-founder in Emerson Hall.
His number two.
Yeah, his number two.
Dr. Evil and Mini Me.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, I was surprised to learn that when he started it, his number two was definitely involved in the creation of it. I mean, I think Emerson Hall only stuck around for about two more years, and then he moved on to Chula Vista, California. But that was the most surprising, is he had a co-founder.
Did he do the same thing out in Chula Vista?
I don't know much of what he did in Chula Vista, but I think Chula Vista already had a zoo at that point. So
he was our get it done guy for the zoo, basically. Gene said, get it done.
It could be, or he conceived the idea. I'm still not 100% sure, but I know he's the one that really made it happen. The Prairie Dog Town, anyway.
David Layton, David Turpey, and Nicole Kaith here with Alan Kaith on Jump in Tucson. We'll be back in just a minute after these break. Buying some time. Say it with me. Come on. You remember The Wizard of Oz from 1939?
Oh, I know.
Oh, come on. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
You say so.
Back in Jump in Tucson. I can't believe that you're such a fun sucker with the Wizard of Oz and all those great animals there in the Wizard of Oz that were humans. David Layton, David Turpie, and Nicole Keith, my daughter, my tail ender, as they say, of four. She's number four and has a keen interest in the veterinary science program, and so she's doing that at JTED right now. Tell me how you get the book, David Turpie.
Well, people can purchase it on the Arizona Historical Society website. We have an online store on our website, which is azhs.org. So that's an easy way to do it. Or you can come by our museum, which is on 2nd Street near the U of A campus, the main gate square. We have a gift store in our museum.
And there's free parking.
There's free parking.
That's important at the U of A because a lot of people stay away from there. Yeah, what's it? It's on the corner of, I forget the parking garage.
It's 2nd and Euclid. It's the main gate square garage. So just park in there and you can get your ticket validated at our museum.
It's worth the price of the admission to the museum just to get free parking at the U of A.
Absolutely. And we got some great stuff in the museum. We have Wyatt Earp's pistol, and we have the stagecoach that was used for the movie Arizona, which David is researching a little bit, and we have lots of great stuff, so it's worth it just to come to see the museum and then purchase a copy in the gift store.
So is this the beginning of a beautiful relationship because you're now researching something with the Earps?
I'm not researching anything with the Earps. I'm researching the how the movie Arizona came about, uh-huh. and then which then created Old Tucson. So that's what I'm currently researching now that this project's done. This 3-year project I've been researching for 3 years, the zoo. I'm currently researching how the movie Arizona came about with Gene Arthur and William Holden, and then obviously the creation of Old Tucson.
So what your tribute over at the little church there when you got this wonderful award from the Tucson Museum, Tucson
Pima County Historical Commission. Yeah.
You asked someone, and they repeated it, if they knew a person named Nixie.
Oh, no, it was Nixie Hall.
Is that how does that work out into your new incarnation of research here?
So one of the recent articles I did was on a man named Nixie Hall. He had been the manager of the old Santa Rita Hotel, which was located downtown on Broadway and Scott Avenue. It's where the TEP building is now. So I was researching his life and found out that he was the one that found out that Columbia Pictures had bought the movie rights to the book Arizona by Clarence Buddington Keelan. He went out to Hollywood, spoke to Columbia Pictures, and convinced them that they need to film that movie here in Arizona. They were probably going to film it at the ranch in Burbank or somewhere around there, but he is the one that got Columbia out here, and they constructed an exact replica or close to it of what Tucson looked like during the Civil War. And so that made him the founder of Old Tucson. Most people know about Robert Shelton and the great work he did starting in, I think, 1959, turning into the amusement park and what it is today. But Nixie Hall was the one that originally convinced Columbia Pictures to come out here and build that, to film it, and that resulted in them building Old Tucson. If it wasn't for Nixie Hall finding out that they had the movie rights and going out there and using his connections in Hollywood, we wouldn't have Old Tucson today. So Nixie Hall is truly the founder of Old Tucson. Now, a few years after Nixie Hall did this, he ended up moving out to Los Angeles, and then he passed away, and people basically forgotten about him. He wasn't somebody that anyone really knew, but he should be credited correctly as the founder of Old Tucson Studios.
And was he also the, quote, mayor of Old Tucson?
Yeah, one of the funny bits is when they were originally going to do some filming, the cast was so appreciative of him for the work he had done because, he took care of all their needs at the hotel, and he really went all out to
free rooms and free food.
I don't know if it was free rooms or free food, to be honest with you. He did take good care of his guests, and he would take trips back and forth to Hollywood and Tucson and just make sure all their needs were taken care of. He was one of those hands-on guys.
Yeah.
that did everything himself and really cared about making sure that his guests were always taken care of. And in appreciation for him and the fact that he also got Columbia out here to film, the cast and crew of Arizona voted him mayor of Old Tucson. And so, and then the governor, Robert T. Jones, a couple months later, made it official and gave him a big award and stuff like that as the mayor of Old Tucson. So he is the founder and mayor of Old Tucson.
He really was, like you said, not taking anything away from the late Bob Shelton. He really was Bob Shelton before Bob bought it.
Right, yeah. I mean, I've heard that comparison too, where people say he was like the original Bob Shelton.
He really was. Yeah. He really was.
I mean, they did things a little bit different, but the interesting thing is, from what I've heard and in just talking to people, they were funded basically by the same guy. I think his name was Barney Goodman. So Barney Goodman owned the Santa Rita Hotel and then provided the wealth for...
To build it.
Yeah, well, it was like the money for... Nixie Hall to make trips to Hollywood, yeah, and do all the stuff that he did.
The T&E, travel and entertainment budget.
Yeah, you could say that, yeah. And then I think he also, from what I verbally heard, I didn't research this, but after it came out, I talked to people, and they said that Goodman was also behind Shelton to a certain degree, whatever degree it was.
We're rapidly running out of time. I want to be able to wrap it up and do it properly with the book here, but I also have a few other questions for you. You have done wonderful, expansive pieces about the Speedway and the Miracle Mile with me. Also, the history of Gates Pass with me. And those aired on Channel 9 and are still available on their website if you want to go and see them. Do you have anything in terms of... we know that if you can give us just a little history about the Speedway mess...
You're referring
real to... Real quick, yeah.
To Speedway being called the ugliest street in America.
In America by Time Magazine, yeah. Or yeah. Life Magazine, sorry.
Yeah, Life Magazine. Yeah, I mean, a quick version basically is they got... I mean, it was a kind of confusing mess where... I think it was the mayor or something like that called it the ugliest speedway or something like that.
Lou Davis.
I think that, yeah. I'm trying to remember.
It was
that.
Lou.
Yeah, it was a few years ago.
Not Murphy Davis.
Yeah, Lou Davis and stuff like that. It's publicly stated it was the ugliest street in America. Then there was a big controversy about it. And then he pointed to the fact that someone else had originally called it that. But it became a big deal. And, you know, it's almost like a pride thing for Tucson now.
Yeah.
Where like, yeah, our speedway was called the ugliest street in America or something to that effect.
Not anymore. It's halfway decent looking. Grant's the ugliest street in Tucson right now. David Turpie from the Arizona Historical Society. Give me the website, phone number, and anything else about the book.
Yeah, sure. The website is azhs.org. And we have an online store on our website. You can purchase the Journal of Arizona History there. You can also sign up for a membership to the Arizona Historical Society, and you'll receive 4 copies of the Journal of Arizona History every year in your mailbox.
And they're all different themes.
All different themes, all different topics, yeah.
David Layton, good friend, thank you for coming. The contributor of the Tucson Randolph/Reed Park in this quarterly journal. And my daughter, Nicole Ann Kaith, age 16, who had some great questions and who's interested in the veterinary sciences. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I'm Alan Kaith, and for Ed Ackerley. Ed will be back. We'll see you soon.